Hybrid battlefield.
President Trump says he will end the Iran war whenever he wants to.
The reality of the conflict is much more complex.
For Thursday, March 12th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Ilse Chang. The Trump White House's decision to slash foreign aid spending had ripple effects around the world.
En lugar de abrir más lugares,
instead of opening more places for more women, we're reducing them. It is hard.
And how do American voters feel about the ongoing Iran war?
We'll put the question to a panel of Michigan voters NPR has been checking in with.
I feel like we always have money for bombs, but no money for infrastructure.
Plus, why forecasters are saying this summer's El Nino could result in record temps.
Those stories and so much more after this summary of the day's news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. A man armed with a rifle rammed his truck into a synagogue in suburban Detroit today. As Russ McNamara from Detroit Public Radio reports, the attacker is dead. What motivated him is still unknown.
There was an exchange of gunfire at Temple Israel in West Bloomfield Township. However, the only injury was a security guard who was struck by the vehicle. Oakland County Sheriff Mike Bouchard says he had been working with local police in preparation for a potential attack at area synagogues since the start of the war with Iran.
We've been talking for 2 weeks about the potential, sadly, of this happening, so there was no lack of preparation.
Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer called the attack heartbreaking and that, quote, Michigan's Jewish community should be able to live and practice their faith in peace. For NPR News, I'm Russ McNamara in Detroit.
Iranian state media aired a statement today attributed to the country's new supreme leader, his first since succeeding his late father. Mujtaba Khamenei says Iran will continue to use the effective closure of the strategic Strait of Hormuz as leverage against the U.S. and Israel.
And also mentioned about how the closing the Hormuz Strait should be used and reopen it if the war is stopped.
The statement was read by a news anchor. Khamenei's absence from public appearances and video has raised questions about his health. Israel suspects the 56-year-old was wounded in the opening salvo of the war. As fuel costs spiked during the Iran war, the White House is considering waiving a century-old shipping law in an effort to ease prices. As NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben reports, doing so would loosen rules on which ships can transport oil and other commodities to the U.S.
The administration may waive the Jones Act, part of the Merchant Marine Act of 1920. The Jones Act requires ships moving between U.S. ports to be made and operated by the U.S. In a statement, Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt said the administration is considering waiving the act, quote, for a limited period of time to ensure vital energy products and agricultural necessities are flowing freely to U.S. ports. The act has been waived before after natural disasters and during international conflicts. In 2011, amid conflict in Libya, President Obama waived the Jones Act to allow foreign ships to transport oil from the U.S. Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News, The White House.
The Professional Women's Hockey League is coming to a TV set near you. The league announced its March 28th game between the New York Sirens and Montreal Victoire will be the first accessible to a national U.S. TV audience. The deal comes as women's hockey enjoys a surge in momentum following the team's gold medal victory at the Olympics last month. It'll air on ION in a one-time deal that could potentially turn into a long-term partnership. This is NPR News. Georgia's film industry is struggling. The state's generous tax credits once turned Atlanta into the Hollywood of the South, drawing hundreds of productions and transforming the local economy. But spending has tumbled from its peak of $4.4 billion in 2022 to just $2.3 billion in the last fiscal year. The 2023 writers and actors strike accelerated the decline, and Marvel has since shifted its productions to the UK. Congressman James Clyburn of South Carolina has announced that he will run for re-election. South Carolina Public Radio's Luis Alfredo Garcia reports the Democrat was first elected in 1992.
Representative James Clyburn is among the oldest Democrats in Congress. The 85-year-old is serving his 17th House term. He announced plans to run again despite calls for generational change within the Democratic Party. But Clyburn says he still feels fit for the task and that this next campaign will be vigorous.
I do believe that I'm very well equipped and healthy enough to move into the next term.
South Carolina's 6th district is heavily Democratic. Clyburn says he has the support of House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries. For NPR News, I'm Luis Alfredo Garcia in Columbia, South Carolina.
States are setting new rules for cash purchases after the U.S. Mint stopped making pennies and the one-cent coins get scarcer. Some states are considering legislation to allow or require businesses to round those purchase totals to the nearest nickel. Indiana already requires rounding for cash sales that do not end in 0 or 5 cents. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, celebrating a century of supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. More at mott.org/100.
It is 6 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. We receive support from the First State Bank of Big Fork, with branches in Big Fork and Kellyer, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device. Hometown banking at its best since 1912. FSBBigFork.com, member FDIC. And coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team. Now we'll take you back to All Things Considered.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. Today, Iran's new supreme leader issued what we think is his first official statement as supreme leader. In it, Mujtaba Khamenei vowed to keep the Strait of Hormuz closed and vowed to continue attacks on U.S. interests in the Middle East. Khamenei did not read the statement himself. Another person was heard reading it while a photo of the supreme leader posted on the TV screen. The message comes on this, the 13th day of war with Iran, a war that seems to be ushering in a new phase of combat, one that is both high-tech and low-cost. I discussed this earlier today on NPR's National Security Podcast, Sources and Methods, along with NPR International Correspondent Daniel Estrin and Pentagon Correspondent Tom Bowman. Tom, you and I have spent a fair bit of time recently on this podcast talking drones, how they are changing warfare. Iran is using them very effectively in this war.
No, they are indeed. And Iran has many, many thousands of Shahed drones, and they're using them, as you say, effectively. They killed 6 American soldiers at a facility in Kuwait. The U.S. is rushing air defenses, anti-drone technology, and attack drones to the region. But the bottom line is this. There are so many drones. Shahed drones. They're small, they're fast, you can swarm them. It's hard to hit every single one. So some of them are getting through.
Well, and it's been fascinating to watch. It's almost like an arms race unfolding between this war, between the ongoing war in Ukraine with Iran and Russia and the U.S. and Ukraine and all these players trying to just stay one step ahead of each other with drones.
No, there's no question about that. It's especially in Ukraine. This is really the first drone war in Ukraine. And I'm told every day 6,000 drones go back and forth between Russia and Ukraine and Ukraine into Russia. And every several days, Ukrainians are changing their software and their drones. They are the masters of drones as we speak. But it is changing
and
warfare.
And the U.S. is tapping them, saying, hey, help us.
Yeah,
share your expertise.
Right,
how do you do what you do so we can apply it in this
Iran war? Ukrainians are coming to the United States helping the Americans with drone technology, with tactics. You know, what's really amazing is the Americans got a hold of one of these Shahed drones in Ukraine. The Ukrainians turned it over to the Americans, and they actually re-engineered the Shahed drone at this company in Arizona. Now they're cranking out basically re-engineered Shaheds, and they're calling them Lucas. And again, this is a game changer for warfare. This is much like the machine gun in World War One, and the dawn of aircraft in World War One as well. This is, again, changing warfare forever.
Daniel, Israel is a player with drones, but I want to ask you about a different technology that Israel is using to target Iran. Walk us through the cyber war that Israel is waging.
Yeah, it's Israel, it's the U.S., it's also Iran. They're all fighting, maybe even more than ever before, out in the open and on this kind of hybrid battlefield. a battlefield that combines the physical and the digital worlds. So this involves, for instance, Israel is believed to have used AI to synthesize billions of data points to, data that they collected, and Israeli intelligence agencies collected in Iran, in order to synthesize all that and to build a bank of targets in Iran. It's also combining the cyber world with this very ancient art form in warfare of deceiving your enemies. And Israel's done a lot of that.
Talk me, like, what does that actually look like? Give me an example.
I spoke to a senior military official in Israel's planning and operations directorate in the military headquarters, who gave me a few details. He called this white noise tactics that Israel deployed at the start of the war to maintain the element of surprise, so Iran wouldn't know that Israel was about to launch this opening blitz and kill the Supreme Leader and many more of its top leadership. For instance, this official told me that Israel assumed that Iran had access to Chinese satellite imagery spying on Israel. And so the U.S. amassed their warplanes in southern Israel in the days before the strike, trying to distract Iran from what was really going on, which was Israel planning that surprise blitz from a base in northern Israel. Another tactic he said they used was making sure that Israel's military generals didn't have their cars parked in their normal parking spots at military headquarters the night of the strike, in case any Iranians were watching. So there's that, and then there's psychological warfare that Israel has been employing. In last year's Israeli war in Iran, Israel bombed the notorious Evin prison in Tehran. And this official told me that after they did that, they actually sent videos of the bombing to Iranian officials. Basically, the message being, you're not as strong as you think. So intimidating them.
That was NPR international correspondent Daniel Estrin in Tel Aviv and Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman. You can hear more of what we talked about on NPR's national security podcast, Sources and Methods. Listen, subscribe, review, wherever you get your podcasts.
For decades, the U.S. spearheaded global efforts to combat gender-based violence. In President Trump's first term, Ivanka Trump led the charge. In the Biden administration, ending violence against women was seen as key to stopping a root cause of migration. Then Trump took office again. And as NPR's Gabriella Emanuel reports, when U.S. foreign aid was slashed last year, efforts to fight gender-based violence were hit hard.
Over 30 years ago, Lisette urged her younger sister to go to the police in Honduras. Her sister, who was pregnant, was being abused by her husband.
Ella lo hizo, pero cuando regresó a su casa,
she did that, but when she returned home, she experienced terrible moments for having reported the aggressor.
That's when Lisette teamed up with a few other women and started one of Honduras's first women's shelters. It soon became her life mission. She worked for policy change. She opened more women's shelters. Then, Lisette says, this past year, much of what she built crumbled. NPR agreed to only use her middle name because she fears speaking out might undermine future financial support. Lisette shared the story of a 22-year-old woman who loved painting intricate geometric patterns called mandalas.
She always wanted to paint mandalas, 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 and many colors. She said that's how she wanted her life, with everything colorful.
She had come to the shelter after being abused by her partner.
Había sido agredida.
She had been assaulted not only psychologically, but also physically and sexually. He has weapons, so it was very easy for him to kill her, and he told her that.
The woman stayed at the shelter for a while, but Lisette's shelters have lost hundreds of thousands of dollars in the past year because of U.S. foreign aid cuts. Lisette needed beds for other women arriving with kids and physical injuries. Lisette remembers the 22-year-old begging to stay.
Que la mujer decía, pónganme a dormir sentada, decía.
She would say, put me to sleep sitting up, in any spot you want, or if you want, give me food once a day, but don't let me go. I can't go back.
Lisette had already cut back on medical care, psychological support, legal services. These days, they can't afford diapers and formula for the children who arrive with their mothers. And in the line of bunk beds, multiple kids already pile into the same bed as their mom.
Ella se tuvo que ir. Lo que hicimos fue buscarle una red de apoyo.
She had to go. What we did was find her a support network through a church so they could place her somewhere else.
And that's a better outcome than most. Lisette says her organization has had to turn away more than 100 women and children this past year. She says it feels cruel to turn them away, especially as the number of women being killed in Honduras goes up.
En lugar de abrir más lugares.
Instead of opening more places for more women, we're reducing them. It is hard. Hard.
Eso es duro, duro.
You can consider them representative of what is happening.
That's Beatriz Garcia-Nice. She's an analyst at the Washington, D.C. think tank, the Stimson Center.
The United States was the leader in supporting this work.
Garcia-Nice says the term gender-based violence got swept up in the anti-DEI bent of the second Trump administration.
It was just literally getting rid of anything that made a reference to gender.
Garcia-Nice says the impact is very real. One in three women experience physical or sexual violence in their lifetime, the World Health Organization reports, and this used to be a bipartisan issue.
In many countries, it has become an issue of the left. It's not a human rights issue anymore. It's kind of radioactive.
The State Department wrote in a statement to NPR that the U.S. continued to provide life-saving assistance to women and children last year, while not supporting the radical ideologies of Biden-era programs that deny biological reality. An October 2025 UN report found that at that time, more than 40% of organizations working on violence against women and girls had shut down or scaled back significantly in the past year as a result of funding cuts. In Honduras, Lisette says she sees no glimmers of hope.
We believe that this year the crisis will deepen.
She says many women, just like her sister, will need refuge and have fewer and fewer places to turn. Gabriela Emanuel, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is The Set List on KAXC, where we highlight live music around the area for the upcoming week. I'm Malachi Coombs. We've got a tour with three stops across the Northland, plus a spring bash and a St. Urho's Day celebration, Friday through Saturday, March 13th and 15th, with shows in Virginia, Bemidji, Walker, and Grand Rapids. First up, two legends of Native Arts are touring through northern Minnesota from Thursday to Saturday. Keith Sokola and Gary Farmer are bringing the Ancestral Fires Tour to Virginia, Bemidji, and Grand Rapids. Sokola, writer of the Native anthem Indian Cars, has been releasing albums since the early 90s, and Farmer, an acclaimed First Nations actor, is a folk rock songwriter with two albums to his name. You'll recognize him for iconic roles in the film Dead Man and the TV show Reservation Dogs. On Thursday, the tour kicks off at Chair in Virginia at 6 p.m., heads to Rail River Folk School in Bemidji, 7 p.m. Friday, and Saturday will be at the Rife Center in Grand Rapids at 2. Back in Virginia on Friday night, Steve Sokola will be celebrating Finnish culture with a St. Urho's Day concert at the Arrowhead. Sokola is a one-man band wrecking ball and the second coming of legendary northern Minnesotan Bobby Aro. Expect lots of accordion, bells and whistles, and raunchy jokes. Friday night at 7 p.m. Finally, on Saturday in Walker, Scarlet Woods is playing Green Scene Market and Eatery's annual Spring Brunch Bash at 11 a.m. Woods is a talented singer-songwriter and guitar player who blends folk, jazz, and rock into her deeply personal songwriting. The set list is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, and we'll post the latest edition every Wednesday at kaxe.org.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere. At uma.com/NPR.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ilse Chang.
And I'm Scott Detrow. In the opening strike of their war on Iran, the U.S. and Israel killed the Islamic Republic's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. It is an exceedingly rare instance of a democracy killing a foreign head of state. And not for the first time in U.S. history, it raises the question, should the United States be in the business of assassinating foreign leaders? NPR's Ryan Lucas reports.
In the first few decades of the Cold War, the United States wanted to keep all options on the table, including assassinations, in its global struggle against the Soviet Union. Luca Trenta is a professor at Swansea University in the UK and the author of a book on assassinations in U.S. foreign policy.
There was certainly a sense that assassination was just another contingency, something that the United States could not entirely exclude in the confrontation with the Soviet Union that was seen as this sort of all-powerful and terrible enemy.
Trenta says in the early Cold War, the U.S. often set the stage for the removal or killing of a foreign leader, but local allies pulled the trigger. That was the case, he says, in the 1961 assassination of the Dominican leader, Rafael Trujillo.
As dictator Rafael Trujillo is shot down by seven assassins.
The CIA in this era also, of course, plotted to assassinate Congolese Prime Minister Patrice Lumumba and Cuban leader Fidel Castro. This was all done in the shadows, and it came tumbling out in public in the mid-1970s when revelations of CIA abuses led to congressional investigations, including one known as the Church Committee. That panel issued an interim report that declared assassinations, quote, incompatible with American principles, international order, and morality, end quote, and said they should be rejected as a tool of foreign policy. Again, Trenta.
I think the investigations of the Church Committee really provide a brief moment of self-reflection for U.S. politicians, for the U.S. public, in which there is a sense that maybe if we are a democracy and if we are to be different from the enemies that we are supposedly fighting, we should not be doing these things.
In 1976, President Gerald Ford did exactly that. He issued an executive order banning the U.S. government from engaging in political assassinations. Timothy Naftali is a historian at Columbia University.
Gerald Ford felt that this was not a tool that he wanted to use. And what's really interesting is that his successors expanded the ban. So Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter both felt that the United States should not be in the assassination business.
And for the next 20-plus years, the U.S. was not, although with an asterisk or two. In 1986, the U.S. bombed several sites in Libya, including leader Muammar Gaddafi's family compound. And twice in the 1990s, the U.S. struck Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein's palaces. Brent Scowcroft was President George H.W. Bush's national security advisor. Here is Scowcroft talking to ABC News' Peter Jennings about the U.S. targeting of Saddam in 1991.
Do you want him killed?
We don't do assassinations. But yes, we targeted all the places where Saddam might have been.
So you deliberately set out to kill him if you possibly could?
I guess, that's fair enough.
Naftali says these operations weren't cloak-and-dagger conspiracies to kill a foreign leader, but instead military operations against command and control facilities. But, of course, the U.S. wouldn't have wept any tears, he says, if Saddam or Gaddafi had been killed.
I think that's how Presidents Reagan, Bush, and Clinton got around the assassination ban.
That reflects, at least in part, he says, that presidents themselves found assassinations distasteful and knew the American public felt the same way. That changed on September 11th, 2001, with the Al-Qaeda terrorist attacks that killed more than 3,000 people. Congress responded by authorizing all necessary means to go after the perpetrators of 9/11, Naftali says.
Well, all necessary means includes assassination. And I think that the taboo, if you want to call it an elite and public taboo against using assassination, disappears.
In the post 9/11 world, the U.S. adopted a new technology, the armed drone, to kill al-Qaeda leaders around the globe. But these strikes targeted alleged terrorists, not foreign government officials. President Trump blurred that line when he announced a deadly drone strike in 2020 against Iranian General Qasem Soleimani.
Soleimani has been perpetrating acts of terror to destabilize the Middle East for the last 20 years.
While the U.S. considered Soleimani a terrorist, he was a high-ranking Iranian government official. Iran responded with plots of its own to assassinate Trump, as well as senior administration officials. Now, 6 years later, a joint U.S.-Israeli operation has killed Iran's political and religious leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. The U.S. provided intelligence while Israel conducted the lethal strike. President Trump has crowed about the operation, saying on social media that Khamenei, quote, was unable to avoid our intelligence and highly sophisticated tracking systems, end quote. Those sophisticated intelligence and military capabilities make it increasingly easy to kill foreign leaders, experts say. And that carries with it a whole host of strategic, philosophical, and moral implications. And Swansea University professor Luca Trenta says, just because a country can assassinate a foreign leader doesn't mean that it should.
I think the Khamenei assassination is a major deal because democracies have killed a foreign heads of state, because other countries might follow the same example, and there will be nothing that democracies will be able to say when that happens.
The moral high ground is lost, he says, and perhaps along with it, the taboo against such assassinations. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
Federal forecasters say that an El Nino is likely to develop later this year. It's a weather pattern that raises temperatures globally. Combine that with climate change and new records could be set. Lauren Sommer reports from NPR's Climate Desk.
Along the equator, the Pacific Ocean is abnormally warm right now. That could soon shift the planet into an El Nino, a cycle that has global impacts.
There are some growing signs that a quite substantial, if not very strong, El Nino event could potentially be brewing.
Daniel Swain is a climate scientist with the University of California Agriculture and Natural Resources. He says El Nino is a natural cycle the planet goes through, a way that the ocean is connected to the atmosphere.
Its function in the global Earth system is to release heat from the deeper ocean.
So years with an El Nino are generally hotter than normal. And these days, temperatures are already hotter because of climate change. Emissions from burning fossil fuels have made the planet about 2 degrees Fahrenheit warmer on average since the Industrial Revolution. 2024, the hottest year on record, was an El Nino year.
Global warming is giving more energy to the whole system to be unearthed by these El Nino events when they occur.
And Swain says that doesn't just mean more heat waves.
Maybe the more important thing is what it means for everything else in terms of more energy potentially for storms, heavier downpours, more intensive droughts, more extreme wildfires.
Federal forecasters say the El Nino is likely to develop this summer, but it wouldn't peak until later on. Zeke Hausfather, a research scientist at Berkeley Earth, says that could lead to some new records.
If a strong El Nino does develop, it'll boost temperatures in 2026 a bit, but it'll have a particularly large effect on temperatures in 2027. And it is likely that 2027 will be the warmest year on record.
Hausfather says there are also signs that climate change is accelerating. The Earth is heating up faster now than it was a few decades ago. And that's like adding a permanent super El Nino to the planet every decade. Lauren Sommer, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
It is 529, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. Coming up next is the Up North Report. Actors Repertory Theater presents three viewings, a trio of one-act plays set in a funeral home, now through March 21st at the Dryden Theater on the campus of Central Lakes College in Brainerd. Find showtimes and tickets at clcperformingarts.com. Weather tonight, snow continues with accumulations of half an inch to 8 additional inches, low 17 to 24.
For
KAXC News, I'm Chelsea Perkins with the Up North Report. The U.S. Senate passed a bipartisan housing bill Thursday that represents the largest in 30 years, aimed at improving affordability and availability through a variety of means. Included in the package that passed 89-10 was a bill authored by Minnesota Senator Tina Smith, titled the Rural Housing Service Reform Act. NPR reports that many of the bill's provisions are meant to boost the United States housing supply. The bill would also ban institutional investors from buying single-family homes with few exceptions. According to Senator Smith, her bill would preserve up to 400,000 affordable homes in rural communities across the country and more than 9,000 units in Minnesota. This would be accomplished by updates to programs at the USDA's Rural Housing Service for the first time in decades.
Think of the elders who live on a fixed income who want to stay in the communities where they raise their families, or people who are living with disabilities or working poor families. Most of the properties in the Rural Housing Service were built in the 1960s with the help of federal mortgages to finance them. And often they were the only affordable places to call home in rural communities. Today, many of these homes are in disrepair, and the Rural Housing Service is in desperate need of reform and modernization.
Fixes include making it easier for nonprofits to assume the mortgages of rural housing properties to fix them up and preserve them for future renters, and giving the service more capacity to work with local banks on financing by modernizing computer systems. The bill will move to a conference committee to iron out some of the differences between the version that already passed in the House. A craft cannabis company proposed for Second Harvest Northland's warehouse in La Prairie is not expected to move forward. Megan Buffington has the story.
Just as plans for a cannabis microbusiness in La Prairie started to move forward, they came to a halt. The city council approved a conditional use permit on March 2nd, allowing the growth, production, and sale of cannabis products. The applicant planned to buy the shuttered Second Harvest warehouse off Highway 2, but they found out Thursday that the nonprofit has entered a letter of intent with another purchaser. Second Harvest Northland CEO Shea Morris says the building has not yet been sold, and she can't share any details about potential plans.
You know, I need full board approval before we can move forward to the new public communication.
La Prairie City Clerk Lisa Murnack says she can't comment on the impact of the potential sale because they have no idea who might be buying the building. But,
you know, we're always happy to have new businesses come in the city.
Second Harvest closed its food bank on the property last year, but the connected food shelf is still serving visitors. But the location is out of the way for many visitors, and surveys show they'd prefer the food shelf to be closer to other services. Morris says Second Harvest has narrowed a new location to three options. The hope is to have a clearer direction in the next few months and then move as soon as possible.
Our plan is to have no disruption to our neighbors in terms of our food shelf program move. That's our desire and our hope.
Second Harvest's board of directors meets at the end of the month, and Morris says there may be more updates in early April. Megan Buffington, KAXE News.
Despite this week's taste of winter, Minnesota lakes will soon lose their ice cover. Ahead of the seasonal change, crews are deploying the latest strategies to restore lake ecosystems overwhelmed by invasive plants. Minnesota implemented a higher surcharge on boat licenses this year to help local entities pay for controlling aquatic invasive species. Meanwhile, in Scott County, the Cedar Lake Improvement District hired PLM Lake and Management to drill holes through the ice and insert an herbicide that specifically targets invasive plants like curly-leaf pondweed. PLM's Patrick Selter says this plant grows throughout the winter, wreaking havoc when boating season arrives.
About mid to late May, early June, that plant will top out. You can't navigate through it. It's hard to fish in. It really limits your recreational use of a lake.
Selter says over the past decade or so, the response to aquatic invasive species in Minnesota lakes has shifted from weed control to restoration.
The native plants, they are our biological control. We don't have biological controls for some of these species, and our only biological control is our native plants.
Thanks to Minnesota News Connection for this story. That's it for the Up North Report from the KAXE News Desk. I'm Chelsea Perkins, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is made possible by Woodland Bank, serving the area since 1920 with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River. Woodland Bank believes in building community and serving local nonprofits like KAXE.
Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Amazon Business, offering business buying services from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. From your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting, yptc.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ilse Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Scott Detrow in Washington. The war in Iran is not popular with the American public. That is according to various public opinion polls. But what are voters saying about why they feel that way? For that, we turn to NPR senior national political correspondent Mara Eliason. Hey, Mara.
Hi there, Scott.
So you observed two focus groups this week. Tell us about them and why they matter.
Well, as you said, polling gets at the what. Focus groups get at the why. These results are not statistically significant, but focus groups let us hear from voters in their own words. And this focus group is part of NPR's monthly Swing Voter Project. It's conducted by the research firms Engages and Sago. All these voters voted for Joe Biden in 2020, and then they all voted for Donald Trump in 2024. We do a different battleground state each month. This month, it was 12 swing voters from Michigan.
All right, so let's have the big reveal then. I'm curious what these 12 voters had to say about Trump's decision to go to war.
They do not approve. I've been thinking about this group as the Marjorie Taylor Greene focus group because they all believed him, and these voters sound very America first when they criticize the war and the president. They sound a lot like Trump himself when he was running for president. So let's hear from some of them. The first one is Lindsay, who's a self-described independent. I should note these voters agreed to be in the group on the condition they be identified by first names only. But here's why Lindsay doesn't approve of Trump's war in Iran.
The enormous cost of war in terms of what it does to our economy, what it does to the world economy, when we have enormous need within our own societies in Michigan, we need to help our own citizens first before we go to Iran, Iraq, I don't know, anywhere else to fight their wars for them.
So Lindsay illustrates one of my biggest takeaways. The war in Iran just melds together in her mind with the war in Iraq. Mm-hmm. Some of these voters could have been in a Trump ad. This is what he ran on. No foreign wars. Stop spending money overseas. Put American citizens first, as Lindsay said. Stop fighting other countries' wars for them. Some of our voters thought Trump was putting Israel's interests first, not the U.S. And there's no separating military action abroad with domestic problems at home for these voters. They believe the war is causing prices to go up at home. Here's Brandon, another independent.
The cost of gas has gone up 20 cents in my neighborhood. So I feel like we always have money for bombs, but no money for infrastructure.
Mara, given how much gas prices have gone up so quickly, I imagine he was not the only one who talked about that.
No, he wasn't. And what's interesting is this is the third of these focus groups we've done. We've done them in Georgia and Arizona before this. Gas prices in the earlier focus groups had been a positive for President Trump. They were coming down. That and the closure of the southern border were his two most popular achievements. So Trump has tried to say this is just a short-term blip in oil prices, and if the war doesn't drag on, gas prices could come down and voters may feel better. But right now, the voters in our focus group, at least, are skeptical and they're cynical, and they're especially after years of conflicts overseas and politicians who promised them they wouldn't get involved in conflicts overseas.
And a reminder, these are all people who voted for Trump in 2024. Did they have a message that they would send the president?
Yes, they were asked to give the president advice. I want to play some of that. Here's Brandon, Jasmine, and then Mark.
He should consult Congress first.
It seems like he makes decisions like very quickly without thinking a lot about it. So maybe just take time to think about it first.
I would just say lay out a strategic vision. Like, what are we doing? It just seems very random.
So slow down, be more coherent. These voters had trouble understanding why the U.S. is at war, because there have been shifting rationales. It makes them feel uneasy, creates a sense of chaos. And chaos and high prices combined are bad things for incumbents in a midterm election.
NPR's Mara Eliason, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has been without a permanent director for more than 6 months. Recently, the Trump administration said that Dr. Jay Bhattacharya will become the CDC's interim director while also running the NIH. This is just the latest in a series of disruptions and dismissals. Jess Mador at WABE checks in on the Atlanta-based institution.
On her coffee table at home in Atlanta, Sarah Boehm has a pile of documents from her old CDC job. They're her own employment records. Boehm lost her job in the first big wave of CDC firings last February. About 1,000 people were suddenly let go.
I knew I wouldn't have access to it, and everything was so chaotic that I needed proof of what was happening.
Boehm had worked in the Center for Environmental Health. She handled communications about things like radon, PFAS, contamination, and lead poisoning. Even now, she still can't believe what her termination letter says.
The agency finds that you are not fit for continued employment because your ability, knowledge, and skills do not fit the agency's current needs, and your performance has not been adequate to justify further employment at the agency. And that floored me, because my performance was rated outstanding, and I even got a raise.
The Trump administration later brought back some of the fired workers, but it's also continued to cut more staff and funding. By the end of 2025, the administration had cut about 3,000 people from the CDC, about a quarter of its workforce. Boehm says she's still in mourning.
The harm that's gonna come to people that don't even know what CDC was protecting them from. But for Atlanta, there's a lot of us. There's thousands of CDC employees that live here. We're, you know, your friends, your neighbors, your family. And with the lost income, it has an impact on local businesses also.
Across the street from the sprawling CDC campus is Shri Thai Restaurant. Manager Nathan Chantabong says 40% of their customers are CDC employees. He says business dropped a bit after the firings and also during the government shutdown.
Typically, we would get a catering order for the CDC. We saw it less and less. It's not a really big impact, but you know, catering is a big order. It's a lot of money. It does affect us.
Asked about the cuts, a spokesman for the Department of Health and Human Services, Andrew Nixon, sent NPR an email describing the CDC as broken and bloated under President Biden. For over a year now, former CDC workers have protested every single Tuesday afternoon at rush hour outside the CDC's main entrance. They carry handmade signs saying things like, "Save public health." Ben McKenzie was at a recent protest marking a year since the firings began. He's still employed as a CDC researcher.
It's been heartbreaking to see so many talented, able colleagues be forced out or leave.
McKenzie says current employees also need support, especially after last summer when a man opened fire on CDC buildings. He killed DeKalb County Police Officer David Rose before killing himself. Multiple CDC employees have told NPR the federal government has yet to fully fix the damage to the windows and the buildings hit in last year's shooting.
I think we've all felt the emotional impact of being targets. Right now, to work at CDC is in a lot of ways to be a target.
McKenzie helps run a mutual aid group, one of several that have sprung up in Atlanta. His group has distributed more than $200,000 to help former CDC workers with rent and other needs. For NPR News, I'm Jess Mador in Atlanta.
This story comes from NPR's partnership with WABE and KFF Health News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Each week, a guest draws a card from NPR's wildcard deck and answers a big question about their life. Comedian Chris Fleming is kind of obsessed with Fresh Air host Terry Gross. He talks about her in his new HBO special, Live at the Palace.
The completely unmanageable tension of every episode with Fresh Air with Terry Gross is so refreshing. It feels like every episode was recorded in the space between the living and the dead. It feels like the guest is sitting on one end of a long medieval table and Terry's on the other end, just cleaning a gun.
On Wildcard, Rachel Martin asked him about it.
This is the point in the conversation where I, as the host of an NPR podcast, yeah, need to ask more about your perceived reverence, mm-hmm, for Terry Gross.
My muse?
What is your muse?
Talking about TG right now?
What is...
So...
I'm talking about the Terror. I've never met the Terror, so I don't...
Of course you have.
I mean...
No, I don't even think the Obamas have access to Terry.
She's a mystery.
I mean, Terry records, from what I've heard, in, like, a chamber in Philadelphia facing, like, a window and... Like in like a,
she doesn't want to see the people.
She's in like a sensory deprivation tank, right? She's like on the sea floor, like and no one has access to. She's like the chupacabra if it went to Wesleyan or wherever she went, you know, the mystery of Terry.
But it's also wonderful because we do, as the host of a show where people are supposed to spill their guts, Terry's like, no, thank you. Yeah, people don't need to know me. Like I will be asking the questions here.
I think it's that's the power that I'm tapping into when I try to talk about her. And also, I relate to that. I think that sometimes I think people bleed too much about themselves, and then as soon as when they do, I mean, like comedians, I think sometimes it's like okay, we get it. I think sometimes we know too much about people,
right.
I think there are very few mystical beings left in this world. Sufjan Stevens, Terry Gross. who else?
That's it. It's a short list.
All of Sweden. or Iceland. Sweden or Iceland. But there is such a... I love someone who... activates my magical realism, like who really,
yes.
who ignites
yes.
it. Because I think that's kind of what I do is a lot of the time I'm drawn to magical realism. And Terry, I have been obsessed with Terry Gross for years. And
really?
Yeah.
We need to make this happen. I mean,
I don't know. It's like a point on the horizon.
Don't you need to meet her?
No. I couldn't meet her. Oh. I mean, we could do. I think my heart might just stop. I think I might just evaporate after I met Terry Gross, because my hero's journey is complete, and then I can fade back into the Atlantic.
You can watch the full conversation with Chris Fleming on YouTube at NPR Wildcard. Also, Terry Gross, in fact, went to SUNY Buffalo. Fleming's new HBO special, Live at the Palace, is out now.
Support for Wildcard with Rachel Martin comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at Viking.com.
This is NPR News.
It is 5:48, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from the Move It Real Estate Group, assisting clients with real estate purchases and sales for over 25 years, not only in Grand Rapids, but across northern Minnesota. Move to what moves you. More at moveitrealestate.com. It's St. Urho's Day in Monaga, March 13th and 14th. Opening ceremonies are Friday at 6:30 in the high school gym, followed by a polka dance. There's a parade on Saturday at 12:20, followed by grasshopper hunt. And we receive support from the IM Hotel in Grand Rapids, providing amenities like their large parking lot suitable for trailers and boats, and offering fresh baked breakfast items each day. Additional information available at imhoteltimberlake.com. Elder Circle in Grand Rapids has monthly support groups for caregivers at various times and locations. Find a full schedule at eldercircle.org.
I found a song that
So I found KAXE when I was in college here in Bemidji. I actually can remember being at the stoplights at Dave's Pizza, just jumping radio stations, and it must have been, I want to say it was the Jayhawks, maybe Wilco was on the radio, and it floored me. I was like, wait, how am I hearing this in Bemidji, in northern Minnesota? I thought I had to be in the Twin Cities to get this stuff.
Mark is a member of KAXE. We are people
powered. The music that you hear is not chosen by the government or an algorithm or a corporation. It's chosen by your friends and neighbors. Over 70 hours a week is produced by local volunteers. Support the people of Northern Minnesota and KEXE with your donation now. Go to KEXE.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Ilsa Chang. Remember the zoot suits and slate gray coats that Denzel Washington wore in the film Malcolm X?
Before there was any such thing as a Republican or a Democrat, we were black. Before there was any such thing as a Mason or an Elk, we were black. Yeah.
Or consider the mural-inspired color palette of the men and women in Amistad.
If we are to have any semblance of order in this courtyard,
give us an
Or what about those Afro-futuristic designs in Black Panther?
Wakanda will no longer watch from the shadows. We cannot. We must not.
All of these films have one very important thing in common: the history-making costume designer Ruth E. Carter. She was nominated for an Oscar for all of these movies and took home two Academy Awards for her work in the Black Panther franchise. And her latest nod for costume design in Sinners now makes her the most nominated Black woman in any category in Oscars history. Ruth E. Carter joins us now. Welcome back to All Things Considered. Welcome to NPR West, and congratulations.
Thank you, Elsa. Thank you for having me.
Oh, my God. It's so good to have you here in person. Can I just ask, what does that distinction alone feel like for you, being the Black woman with the most Academy Award nominations in history?
It's a long journey to here, and I've always felt very passionate about telling the African diaspora through film and through cinema. I didn't expect this to come this way. Mm-hmm. But when I think of how much work there is that this is shedding light on, I'm so proud.
Well, let's talk about this latest project, Sinners. This is the work that earned you the latest nomination. The movie, you know, it was set in the 1930s, Mississippi Delta. Was there a central theme or goal that you started with when you approached designing the costumes for this whole world that Ryan Coogler created and directed?
Yes, there was a central theme, and it was the story of the blues.
Traveling, I don't know where the world I'm
in. I came into this loving to recreate Black history. I was well-versed at, like, how I would compile the things that I needed to tell this story, but really what made it rich was that I could fill in some of the stories that, you know, were gaps.
Like, yeah, you saw your role kind of as a historian.
I really saw my role, and I could tell the story of the Great Migration. I could tell the story of sharecroppers, and I could explore a lot of things that I had learned along the way about aging and color palettes. And I thought about Norman Rockwell and how this palette was very simple, and Jacob Lawrence, how the colors just bled together and really made a beautiful composition.
And I also read that you approached costume design in the movie Sinners as a way to safeguard visual truth about Black working class life. Can I ask you, how do you think that truth has gotten distorted, at least in some movies, when you look at the costumes in those movies?
A lot of times we want to highlight the suffering. And within the suffering, there is celebration, there is joy, there is another pathway to liberation. Those are the things that we highlighted with Sinners. We were able to show the sharecroppers and the tattered clothing and the sweat, but we also showed how music created a world for them so that they could escape the hardships of the times and be joyous, even if laws were created to separate us and to strip the culture. They were able to maintain a sense of culture.
What struck me was the variety of the looks among all the characters, because there's Smoke and Stack, the twins played by Michael B. Jordan. Even the contrast between how Smoke and Stack were dressed, like Smoke's clothes had sort of a boxier fit with the denim hat, more working, more everyman, and Stack has like his three-piece suit, his pocket watch. Same actor in both cases, but you could differentiate between the two characters. What did you want to get across in that contrast between the two twins?
We separated the fitting room into two colors. One side was blue, the other side was red.
Yeah.
As we discovered who Stack was, and we put that red hat on and we tailored his suit to the body, a lot more self-conscious. As we put the hat on him, Ryan sees this red hat and he freaks out. How he just loves it. And, you know, before long, the people in the office was like, hey, Ruth, what happened with the red hat? I've been hearing about this red hat. So when it's right, you all feel it.
Yeah. And by the way, this is a red hat you found on Melrose in L.A.?
I found this at a hat shop.
Not in New Orleans.
Sometimes that's the way it goes.
Yeah.
There it was, like calling my name in this tiny little shop.
See, that's what's fascinating to me, because part of costume design is the quest you go on to find the exact perfect pieces. And so when I was watching this movie, I thought, oh my God, this is Ruth E. Carter's first horror film, right? Like, this is a gory, bloody movie. How did it feel to watch blood, fake blood, get splashed on some of these beautiful pieces that you had
that
artfully curated?
Yeah, seeing blood squirted on these beautiful pieces was devastating. I have to admit, I kind of forgot all about the vampire element, the blood element. I was looking at the Great Migration, and then blood happened.
Right.
So you can imagine the amount of multiples we've had.
Yeah, so meticulous. All right, Ruth, let's talk about the larger picture of your huge career, because outside of the movies we've already mentioned, you have worked on more than 50 major motion pictures, many with Spike Lee, now with Ryan Coogler. I want to read a line from a Variety article on your Academy Award nominations and wins. Quote, since 1929, over 3,100 Oscar statuettes have been awarded, and only 20 are in the possession of Black women. That is approximately 0.006%. Ruth, what does that say to you about how Hollywood supports and recognizes Black creatives?
It chokes me up to hear those numbers. Hollywood was not built around our stories or our even inclusion. And that's why it's only now that the Ryan Cooglers and the Spike Lees and John Singletons are celebrated for paving the way. When I first started to work with Spike, he would often say, we need to remember that we can be artists also behind the camera. And that fueled me to bring on other people of color that could exercise their craft and see me as someone who was a leader in that quest. And I think that being the most nominated woman in Oscar history is great, but it's kind of a little bit for the Oscars and for the Academy. It's calling them out a little bit because it shouldn't be that way.
Costume designer Ruth E. Carter, whose work on Sinners has earned her fifth Oscars nomination. Thank you so much, and congratulations, Ruth.
Thank you.
'Cause the woman that I'm loving, she don't want me around here no more.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance, now hiring for virtual and hybrid employment, offering opportunities for professional development and career progression. Position details can be found at careers.progressive.com. From the Lemelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at lemelson.org. And from Easy Cater, a workplace food platform dedicated to making it easy for organizations to order food from a wide variety of restaurants, set up employee meal programs, and manage food spend at easycater.com. This is NPR.
You're listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. We receive support from Grand Rapids State Bank, committed to serving the Grand Rapids area for over 110 years. More at grsb.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. And we are under a winter storm warning in effect until 1 p.m. Friday for much of the region. 4 to 8 inches of snow expected. Otherwise, tonight it should be snow, low 17 to 24 degrees, blustery northwest winds. Tomorrow, cloudy to partly cloudy skies, chance for flurries.
Hello, I'm Neil Coxall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens,